flowed down an epigenetic channel for centuries, at least in toad flax. If we accept culture as a form of heredity, then we can trace some cultural traditions for tens of thousands of years. And even when non-genetic heredity is fleeting, it can still have a big influence on a species. By programming their descendants with spikes and other protections, animals and plants can enjoy long-term evolutionary success, even as their environment changes. This success can have effects that ripple outward across an entire food web. A water flea's spikes allow it to increase in numbers while keeping its predators hungry. Non-genetic heredity matters for another reason. It can potentially steer evolution. Under some conditions, for example, natural selection may favor tall plants over short ones. Plants can reach great heights if they inherit the right alleles, but non-genetic factors can also influence how tall a plant gets. If non-genetic factors make tall plants even taller, they will be able to have even more offspring. In other cases, non-genetic heredity may work against genes, bringing evolution to a standstill. In not only genes, Bondurianski and Day remain agnostic about just how important non-genetic heredity will turn out to be. They are not drumming up hype about epigenetic memories of past lives. They simply consider the question both important and unanswered. Bondurianski and Day have developed mathematical equations and conceptual tools they hope will make it possible to study both forms of heredity at the same time, in the same organisms. They argue that a combination of both kinds of heredity could help address some of the biggest questions scientists still have about the history of life. Why we get old, for example. How peacock tails and other extravagant courtship displays evolve. How new species arise. Even human history could benefit from an expanded view of heredity. If you've recently enjoyed a cone of ice cream or a slice of brie, for instance, you are experiencing one of the more bizarre results of the agricultural revolution. As a rule, mammals don't consume milk in any form once they stop nursing. After weaning, they stop producing lactase, the enzyme required to break down lactose sugar. The same is true for about two-thirds of people worldwide. For them, consuming milk can be an uncomfortable experience, leading to symptoms including bloating and diarrhea. But the remaining 2 billion or so people can continue to drink milk and eat dairy foods as adults. They have inherited mutations that lead them to persist in making lactase. Scientists have found a number of these mutations in the same region of the genome. They alter a genetic switch that controls LCT, the gene for lactase, keeping it from shutting down after weaning. The mutations show signs of having been favored by natural selection within the past few thousand years, and they are found in people who can trace their ancestry back to places with a deep history of cattle herding, such as East Africa, the Near East, and northwestern Europe. All this evidence aligns nicely. It suggests that after some people domesticated cattle, a mutation became common that allowed them to consume milk. At this point, it's tempting to declare the case closed, but Bondurianski and Day point out a paradox embedded in this story. Before the domestication of cattle, very few people inherited LCT mutations. The early cattle herders, in other words, were mostly lactose intolerant. It's hard to see how they would have taken up the practice of consuming milk if it made most of them sick to their stomachs. And if they didn't, then there would be no opportunity for the lactose-tolerant people to thrive on milk and spread their alleles. The way out of this paradox is to recognize that two kinds of heredity were playing out at the same time among early herders: the genetic heredity of LCT mutations and the cultural heredity of milk-consuming traditions. The cultural practice of herding cattle, sheep, and goats started out mainly as a way to get meat. But later, the herders used their creativity to discover other kinds of foods that their animals could provide. They began milking their animals. At first, the lactose-intolerant herders may have only drunk a little milk. But as the milk soured, they may also have discovered that it was easier to digest milk by first turning it into yogurt and cheese, two foods that have much less lactose than regular milk. In Poland, researchers have discovered a 7,200-year-old sieve with milk fat still embedded in it, a sign of early cheesemaking. Once this custom was in place, natural selection could favor people with mutations to LCT. In times of famine, they might be able to fall back on milk as a source of protein and carbohydrates, while others starved to death. Their descendants inherited their LCT mutations, and as lactose persistence became more common, it fostered the spread of the culture of consuming milk. In other words, genetic heredity and cultural heredity started off blocking each other, but in later generations they ended up pushing in the same direction. Bondurianski and Day see another advantage to a broader view of heredity. Putting on blinders and looking only at genes leaves scientists at risk of missing important new discoveries about biology. In the 19th century, for example, physicians believed that parents who drank too much alcohol could pass down feeble-mindedness and other disorders to their children. The physicians were fuzzy on the details of how this happened, falling back on the Bible's promise that God punishes the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. To the early Mendelians, this talk was nothing but old-fashioned Lamarckism. It was impossible for a parent's alcoholism to extend its harm to a future generation. Instead of a cause, it was merely an effect. A faulty gene altered the brain, they assumed, causing hereditary feeble-mindedness. The condition not only caused people to score poorly on intelligence tests, it also left them unable to resist dangerous pleasures such as drink. "We may say that every feeble-minded person is a potential drunkard," Henry Goddard declared in 1914. When Goddard assembled Emma Wolverton's pedigree to prove that feeble-mindedness was hereditary, he eagerly noted every report of alcoholism in the family. He believed that they strengthened his case even more. In the Kallikak family, Goddard popularized this explanation of alcoholism. But even as the Kallikaks appalled the world, other scientists were carrying out experiments that pointed in a different direction altogether. At Cornell Medical School in New York, Charles Stockard and George Papanicolaou wafted alcohol fumes into the noses of guinea pigs shortly before they mated. The alcohol caused a host of troubles in their offspring. Some baby guinea pigs were deformed, and others had low birth weight. They tended to die in infancy, and the survivors had low fertility. Stockard and Papanicolaou even found the same troubles carried over for four generations of guinea pigs. They concluded that the alcohol had violated Weismann's barrier and affected the germ cells. "All future generations arising from this modified germplasm will likewise be affected," Stockard and Papanicolaou concluded. Goddard and other Mendelian-minded scientists weren't swayed by the new research. In 1920, prohibition went into effect and brought medical research on alcohol to a standstill. By the time prohibition was lifted in 1933, genetics had matured so far that scientists generally refused to take a fresh look at Stockard and Papanicolaou's work. While alcohol does not make bad stock, many alcoholics come from bad stock, Howard Haggard and Elvin Jelinek explained in their 1942 book, Alcohol Explored. The fact is that no acceptable evidence has ever been offered to show that acute alcoholic intoxication has any effect whatsoever on the human germ, or has any influence in altering heredity. It wasn't until the 1970s that doctors realized just how wrong Haggard and Jelinek had been. David Smith and Kenneth Jones, both pediatricians at the University of Washington, noticed a cluster of four children who all shared the same symptoms. They had small heads, short statures, and slow intellectual development. They had something else in common, too. Their mothers were all alcoholics. Smith and Jones discovered that other pediatricians were seeing similar symptoms in children. Together they put forward a new condition, known as fetal alcohol syndrome. Heavy drinking during pregnancy, doctors now recognize, can cause a spectrum of symptoms, from brain damage to hyperactivity to poor judgment. In the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates, up to 1 in 20 schoolchildren has fetal alcohol syndrome or related disorders. To understand the biology of the syndrome, scientists in recent years have studied what happens when pregnant rats consume alcohol. Those studies suggest that fetal alcohol syndrome is an epigenetic disease. The ethanol in the drinks alters the methyl groups and other molecules around the DNA in a fetus. As a result, some genes go quiet, while some become more active. It's also possible, although the evidence is thinner, that fathers who drink before conception can contribute to fetal alcohol syndrome too. It's possible that ethanol can also change epigenetic patterns in their sperm, and that this change can carry over into an offspring. Even more tantalizing are experiments finding that male rats can pass down the same epigenetic alterations through two more generations. The molecular details of fetal alcohol syndrome remain fairly mysterious. Yet the discovery of the syndrome itself did not have to wait as long as it did. We can only speculate how much earlier it might have been recognized if scientists were open to the possibility. If Henry Goddard could have learned about it when he trained as a psychologist in the early 1900s, history might have taken a different path. In 1995, a doctor named Robert Karp at the Children's Medical Center of Brooklyn looked over some of the materials Goddard collected to write the Kallikak family. He examined the pictures of children whose parents had been alcoholics. Looking at some of them, Karp was struck by the faces, by their razor-thin upper lip, for example, and by the lack of a philtrum, the vertical groove below the nose. These are telltale signs of fetal alcohol syndrome. Goddard's records, such as the short stature of some of Emma Wolverton's relatives, only strengthened Karp's suspicions. But Goddard himself did not recognize the symptoms. Perhaps it was impossible for him to do so, thanks to his rigid view of heredity. Today, we are still making up for that lost time. Part 5. The Sun Chariot. Chapter 17. Yet Did He Greatly Dare. Phaeton paid a visit one day to his father, Phoebus, the sun god. He went to demand Greek mythology's equivalent of a paternity test. Rumors were swirling that Phoebus was not his father, and Phaeton wanted them put to rest. "Give me proof that all may know I am thy son indeed," he said. Stepping down from his throne, Phoebus embraced Phaeton. He swore to do anything to prove his fatherhood. Phaeton asked him for the one thing that Phoebus wished he could deny, to ride the chariot of the sun across the sky. Phoebus begged Phaeton to ask for something else, anything else. The horses were too strong for Phaeton to master, the course too hard. But Phaeton, supremely confident in his own skill and strength, refused to change his mind. Phoebus realized he was trapped by his own promise and led his son to his gold-wheeled chariot. When Phaeton climbed aboard, the horses suddenly carried the chariot high above the earth. Phaeton went blind with fear. Simply being the son of a god did not mean that Phaeton inherited his father's mastery. The horses galloped off course, dragging the sun down toward the earth and far away again. Where they came too close to the land, it was scorched to desert. Where they rose too high, they left frozen wastelands behind. Phaeton's wild ride did more than permanently alter the landscape. It also left its mark on humanity. When the lurching chariot passed over Africa, the sun dropped so close to the ground that it scorched the people living there. Their blood rose to their skin, turning it black. Their children would inherit their dark skin, as would all future generations. Before long, the earth cried out to Zeus for help, and he responded by hurling a bolt of lightning at the chariot. The sun god's son tumbled to earth, blazing down like a shooting star. Nymphs buried his smoldering body and put a stone over his tomb. "Here Phaeton lies, his father's charioteer," it read. "Great was his fall, yet did he greatly dare." The story of Phaeton, which survives today mostly through Ovid's telling in Metamorphoses, is many different stories bundled together. Among those stories is a tale about heredity. Phaeton's wild ride was an explanation for an inherited difference between people. Ancient philosophers and poets offered many such explanations for why children resembled their parents and why some diseases were inherited. Yet there's also a telling absence in their writings. As far as we know, Aristotle and other ancient scholars never offered instructions for how to alter heredity, how to extirpate inherited diseases, or how to improve the animals and plants their lives depended on. Perhaps those ancient scholars thought humans could no more alter heredity than they could alter the course of the sun. And perhaps they thought that anyone who dared seize such power would be overwhelmed and die. But there's yet another story hidden in Phaeton's tale. It's odd when you think of it that a god like Phoebus would have to use horses to pull his heavenly chariot. Certainly they must have been remarkable horses that could gallop across the sky, but they were horses nonetheless, complete with hooves, tails, and manes, the same animals that pulled the chariots of earthly Greeks in races and battles. And yet the ancient Greeks and their fellow humans transformed their horses in a godlike way. They altered the DNA of the animals, steering them from the genes of their wild ancestors and toward new domesticated sequences. They reared the horses, raising foals to replace their parents in the traces. Each new generation of horses inherited traits from their parents that made them well adapted to this work: powerful hearts, strong bones in their legs, and a willingness to take commands from two-legged apes. This particular combination of traits seems to have first come together about 5,500 years ago, when nomads in Central Asia began to domesticate wild horses. They unknowingly picked out certain variants of certain genes for breeding. Domesticated horses then spread across much of Asia, Europe, and Northern Africa in the millennia that followed. The horses of ancient Greece were thus the product of 5,000 years of modification, and in later years, people continued transforming them into new breeds. Big workhorses like Clydesdales hauled heavy loads, while thoroughbreds galloped swiftly around racetracks. Every breed of horse inherited a particular combination of variants that altered everything about them, their size, their shape, and even their gait. The Greeks and other ancient peoples had more control over heredity than Phaeton had had over his father's chariot, in other words. But they had little idea of what they were doing. They could not directly rewrite genes of horses to precisely meet their needs, creating permanent changes that would be passed down to future generations. They could only choose which horses to breed. The desirable genetic variants they blindly selected sat on stretches of DNA with harmful ones, too. Modern horses pay the price for this blind selection, inheriting genetic variants that make them worse at healing wounds than their ancestors, raise their risk of seizures, and create other vulnerabilities. In the 1800s, a growing number of scientists tried to master heredity's chariot. They ran experiments to find its rules. And yet, even in the early 1900s, controlling heredity still seemed like magic, in both the wondrous and dangerous senses of the word. It was no accident that Luther Burbank earned the nickname the Wizard of Santa Rosa. When the plant scientist George Shull spent time with Burbank, he realized that the wizard had no magic beyond a good eye for interesting flowers and fruits. And it was Shull, not Burbank, who would become the true pioneer of modern plant breeding. Back at Cold Spring Harbor, Shull ran an experiment on some Indian corn he had rescued from the lab's horse feed. He planted the kernels and then carefully pollinated each plant with its own pollen. In time, he created purebred lines of corn. The two copies of every gene in each purebred plant were identical. Shull would pick out one line with the quality he liked, such as extra rows of kernels, and then breed it to another desirable line. Their hybrid offspring inherited a copy of each gene from each parent. Remarkably, the hybrid corn would show many of the traits that Shull selected in the inbred lines, while also growing bigger, healthier ears than their parents. Shull painstakingly improved his inbred lines and found that when he crossed them, they produced even better hybrids. Scientists still argue about why his method worked. It may be that he could eliminate harmful recessive mutations without losing the traits he desired. It may also be that corn and other plants do better when they can use two versions of certain proteins rather than just one. What was immediately clear when Shull began publishing his experiments was that his method would allow farmers to get more food from their crops, what Burbank had originally claimed was his own life's mission. By the 1920s, many plant scientists were following Shull's example, and before long, farmers across the Midwest were filling their fields with hybrid corn. Not only did it produce more bushels per acre, but it also withstood the Dust Bowl droughts better than earlier strains. By the end of the 20th century, plant breeders using Shull's methods had quintupled their yields. Yet enough genetic variation still remained in the corn plants to ensure that they could breed even better hybrid corn for many years to come. Understanding Mendel's law made Shull's hybrid corn possible, and yet Shull still worked for the most part in ignorance. He had no idea which genes he was selecting or how they made his corn better. He simply mixed the existing variations together. It was his combinations that were new. Over the next century, scientists would gradually gain more control over heredity. Some dragged X-ray machines into cornfields and fired beams at the tassels. The radiation triggered new mutations that altered the descendants of the corn. Plant mutagenesis, as this method came to be known, threw out new varieties of pears, peppermint, sunflowers, rice, cotton, and wheat. Bombarding barley gave rise to new kinds of beer and whiskey. Scientists also hurled X-rays at mold, creating strains that could make superior penicillin. Even these successes still depended on a lot of blind luck, though. Heredity remained a slot machine, and plant mutagenesis just gave scientists an extra bucket of coins to play it. More pulls of the arm raised their odds enough that, at some point, the reels would turn up three bars. It wasn't until the 1960s that microbiologists would discover molecular tools that gave them a more precise control over heredity. Many species of bacteria make proteins called restriction enzymes that recognize a short sequence of DNA and cut the molecule wherever that sequence appears. These microbes use their restriction enzymes to defend themselves against attack, specifically by destroying the DNA of invading viruses. Tinkering with these proteins, scientists found that they could also use them to cut other pieces of DNA, even genes inside human cells. Loading such a gene onto a plasmid, a ringlet of DNA, these researchers could then move the gene into a microbe. By the end of the 1970s, researchers created strains of bacteria that carried the gene for human insulin. With the bacteria growing in fermentation tanks, scientists could now manufacture the insulin like living factories. Other researchers went on to use similar methods to do everything from giving crops resistance to viruses to giving mice human-like hereditary diseases. Behind these successes, however, were long stretches of effort and failure. It could take years for scientists to discover a gene worth moving from one species to another, and then years more to load it onto a vehicle that could carry it across the species boundary. And learning how to make that transfer to one species didn't help researchers with another. The tools that made it possible to import genes from jellyfish into rats were useless for moving daffodil genes into rice. And even if scientists succeed in getting genes into a species, they might still fail. The scientists had little control over where a gene would get inserted in an organism's DNA. It might end up in a spot where it could operate smoothly, or it might drop into the middle of other genes, disrupting them and killing its new host. None of these challenges spelled doom for genetic engineering, but they did keep it expensive and limited to labs of scientists with hard-fought wisdom. It wouldn't be until 2013, over a century after Scholl discovered hybrid corn, that scientists would report their discovery of a versatile, cheap way to control the heredity of just about any species. They hadn't thought it up. Just like restriction enzymes before it, it was a system of molecules that bacteria had been using for billions of years to alter their own heredity. In 2006, Jennifer Doudnoe was sitting in her office at the University of California, Berkeley, when she got a phone call out of the blue. A Berkeley microbiologist named Jill Banfield wanted to talk to her about something that sounded like CRISPR. Doudnoe didn't understand what Banfield was talking about, or why she'd want to call her. But Banfield, who searched for new species of bacteria on mountaintops and ocean floors, seemed like a scientist worth talking to. At the time, Doudna studied the RNA molecules made by bacteria, humans, and other species. Most of her work took place in the quiet confines of a test tube. Banfield could enlighten her about the world beyond the tube. The following week, Doudna and Banfield met at a cafe. Banfield introduced Doudna to CRISPR, at least as it was understood in 2006. She drew a diagram for Doudna in a notebook, showing the repeating sequences of DNA that some species of bacteria carried, with different bits of DNA wedged between them. Banfield at the time was discovering CRISPR regions in the DNA of one species after another, and she could see that some of these bits of DNA had come from viruses. Other scientists had begun to explore the possibility that CRISPR was some sort of defense system that bacteria could use to fight viruses, a system they could pass down to their descendants. But nobody knew how it worked. One possibility was that bacteria made RNA molecules to seek out the viruses. Since Doudna was an expert on RNA in bacteria, Banfield wondered if she'd be willing to help find out. Doudna took Banfield up on the offer. She hired a postdoctoral researcher named Blake Wiedenheft to work exclusively on CRISPR, and then gradually the rest of her lab switched over to studying it. A few other labs were also investigating CRISPR at the time. In 2011, Doudna joined forces with a French biologist named Emmanuel Charpentier, and together they figured out that CRISPR, like restriction enzymes, destroys viral DNA. But there was a profound difference between these two lines of defenses. Restriction enzymes had a shape that allowed them to recognize only a single short stretch of DNA, which could appear in many places in a genome. Microbes protected their own DNA from this attack by methylating their own sequences. Viruses, unable to methylate their genes, were left vulnerable to attack. The Cas9 enzymes produced by the CRISPR system were far more sophisticated. bacteria produced RNA guides that could lead the enzymes to one, and only one, stretch of DNA. By storing different RNA guides in their DNA, bacteria could precisely recognize several different strains of viruses. Like any molecular biologist, Doudna was well aware of how restriction enzymes had helped create the biotechnology industry. She wondered if CRISPR might have a similar power. If it could recognize any stretch of DNA in a virus, perhaps Doudna and her colleagues could create RNA guides that would lead the enzymes to a particular spot in the DNA of a cucumber, or a starfish, or a human. To test this idea, Doudna and her colleagues tried to cut out a piece of DNA from a jellyfish gene. The gene is a common tool for molecular biologists because it makes a glowing protein that can light up a cell like a microscopic jack-o'-lantern. Doudna and her colleagues picked for their target a 20-letter stretch. After synthesizing RNA molecules that matched the target, they mixed all the molecules together in a test tube. The RNA guides and Cas9 enzymes combined and sought out the jellyfish genes. When Doudna and her colleagues looked at that DNA afterward, they discovered it was now cut into precisely the fragments they had hoped to create. Four more trials, using RNA guides that sought different targets in the gene, worked just as well. "We had built the means to rewrite the code of life," Doudna later recalled. After Doudna and her colleagues published the details of the experiment in 2012, a CRISPR scramble began. Her team, as well as others, tried to get the CRISPR molecules into living cells. Researchers learned not only how to cut out pieces of DNA from those cells, but how to repair it as well. In one of these experiments, Feng Zhang and his colleagues at the Broad Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, delivered a pair of CRISPR systems into human cells. The molecules landed on two neighboring targets within a single gene and snipped the DNA at both sites, cutting out the short stretch in between. The cell's own repair enzymes then grabbed the two sliced ends and stitched them back together. The procedure, in other words, surgically removed a piece of DNA, leaving no scar behind. And when the cell divided, its descendants inherited that deletion. Before long, scientists were starting to use CRISPR to replace stretches of genes with new sequences. Along with the Cas9 enzymes and RNA guides, the researchers would deliver small pieces of DNA to cells. After the enzymes cut out a section of DNA, the cells would patch the new pieces into the gap. CRISPR was a dramatic improvement on both X-ray mutagenesis and restriction enzymes. CRISPR did not introduce random mutations like mutagenesis, nor was it limited to inserting an existing gene from one species into another. Since researchers were now able to synthesize short pieces of DNA from scratch, CRISPR could potentially let them make any sort of change they wanted to any species' own genes. In the 1970s, Rudolf Jänisch, a biologist at MIT, had used restriction enzymes to engineer mice for the first time. With the advent of CRISPR, he wondered if he could create new lines of mice with that tool as well. Collaborating with Feng Zhang, he and his graduate students and postdoctoral researchers played around with CRISPR until they found a chemical recipe they could use to slip the molecules into a fertilized mouse egg. They were able to alter as many as 5 different genes at once by delivering 5 different RNA guides. Jänisch and his colleagues then implanted these altered eggs in female mice, where they developed into healthy pups. 80% of the time, Jänisch's team successfully engineered precisely the changes they desired. A new generation of graduate students silently thanked Jänisch every day for making their lives easier. Many PhD projects had to start with the creation of a mouse model to study a gene or a disease. It typically took 18 months to create a line of mice, and often it took more than one try to get the mouse right. Now, with CRISPR, Jänisch needed only 5 months to get the job done. I was working as a reporter during those frenzied years, and I did my best to keep up with CRISPR's advances. But very soon, the parade of CRISPR animals became a stampede. Scientists were altering the DNA of zebrafish and butterflies, of beagles and pigs. By 2014, it dawned on me that I was witnessing the beginning of something enormous. Biologists began speaking about their life before and after CRISPR, but I didn't truly appreciate what CRISPR meant to scientists until I returned to Cold Spring Harbor one early spring day to spend an afternoon in a giant greenhouse with cathedral-like ceilings made of glass. A plant scientist named Zachary Lipman led me down narrow aisles past rows of pots, each with a plant climbing a tall stake. Although he was still young, Lippman had a pair of gray patches in the dark beard framing his chin. I wondered if the six children he and his wife were raising might have something to do with them. "They say I do genetics at the lab and then do genetics at home," Lippman said. Lippman has a long history of showing off his plants. Growing up in Connecticut, he worked on a farm where he learned how to grow giant pumpkins. At the peak of the growing season, they put on 10 or 15 pounds a day. "To me, the interest was, how the hell does this thing get so big, and how can I get it bigger?" Lippman said. Heading to Cornell for college, Lippman majored in plant breeding and genetics. There he discovered that scientists had long been asking his boyhood question, not just about pumpkins, but about other fruits and vegetables. One of the key changes to crops during the agricultural revolution was making them bigger, to turn the stubby fruits of teosinte into long ears of corn, to swell the thin, pale roots of carrots into stout orange tubers. Using traditional methods for studying genes, the scientists had found some of the mutations that made these changes possible. They had done a lot of this work on tomatoes, Lippman discovered, because their biology lends them well to genetic experiments. Lippman followed in their scientific footsteps by studying tomatoes, too. "Look at these tiny little berries," Lippman said to me. He had stopped at a tomato plant towering over us. Grabbing a stem, he cradled its fruit. "These plants here are the closest that we know to the first domesticated forms of tomato," he said. The domestication of tomatoes by the indigenous farmers of Peru turned blueberry-sized fruits into the larger kind we find in supermarkets and at farm stands. Lippman's research has helped reveal how those earlier breeders made tomatoes big. It turns out that they had to change the shape of tomato flowers. When a bud on a tomato plant begins developing into a flower, it first divides up into wedges, called locules. From those locules will develop the petals of the tomato flower. And at the center of the flower, those same locules will give rise to the sections of a tomato. One gene controls how many locules form on a tomato plant. Mutate the gene, and the plant makes more locules. And more locules develop into a bigger tomato. This locule-controlling gene was not the only one to mutate during the domestication of tomatoes. Lippman's research has also revealed that the crops adapted to the length of day as the crops were moved to different parts of the world. Lippman and his colleagues found that wild tomatoes, which grow at the equator in South America, are adapted to getting 12 hours of sunlight every day through the year. When they brought wild tomato plants from the Galapagos Islands north to Cold Spring Harbor, they discovered that the plants fared poorly, thanks to the long New York summer days. The plants responded to the extra sunlight with flower-suppressing proteins, delaying the growth of their fruits until the end of the season. But domesticated tomatoes that grow in Europe and North America have acquired mutations that cause the plants to make fewer anti-flowering proteins in the summer. In 2013, Lippman learned that scientists had figured out how to use CRISPR to edit genes in a plant for the first time. He got hold of the molecules and tested them out on tomatoes to see how well they worked. No genetic tool he had used before came close. "It was black and white," Lippman said. "We just sat down and had brainstorming sessions, just saying, what can we do?" One of the first items on their list was to get tomatoes to stop making flower-suppressing proteins altogether in response to long summer days. They used CRISPR to cut out the genetic switch for this activity in domesticated tomatoes. When Lippman and his colleagues planted the seeds of these altered plants, they grew their flowers and their tomatoes 2 weeks ahead of schedule. They might thrive in places with much shorter summers. Now you can start to think about growing some of your best tomato varieties in even more northern latitudes, like in Canada, Lippman said. Lippman had, in effect, created a new crop variety in one step. He did not need the eye of Luther Burbank, scanning thousands of plants for a single promising mutant each year, nor did he need to transfer a gene from some other species to create a genetically modified crop. He directly altered the tomato's own genes, using the knowledge he had gained about how tomatoes work. This success made Lippman's brainstorming more ambitious. He wanted to turn a wild plant into a domesticated crop. And for his new experiments, he chose ground cherries. "I couldn't really appreciate what he was doing," Lippman assured me, "unless I ate some ground cherries first." He brought me a plastic box filled with golden fruits the size and shape of marbles. When I bit into a ground cherry, I tasted a rich flavor that hovered somewhere between pineapple and orange. The fruits were so delicious and so distinctive that I wondered why I hadn't had one before. "The reason," Lippman explained to me, "is that they're wild." Ground cherries, known scientifically as physalis, live across much of North and South America. They grow into bushes and develop their fruit inside a lantern-shaped husk. Native Americans gathered ground cherries to make sauces, and European settlers followed suit. Some collected the seeds and planted them in their gardens. Today, you can buy a packet of ground cherry seeds, and sometimes you can find the fruits for sale at a farmer's market or a gourmet store. But because they're wild, ground cherries remain an oddity rather than a crop. The fruits ripen one by one through a long season, and gardeners have to wait for them to drop to the ground before collecting them, hence their name. Lippmann has long had a scientific curiosity about ground cherries because they belong to the same family as tomatoes. Their close evolutionary relationship means that they have a lot of biology in common. Both ground cherries and tomatoes form their flowers and fruits from locules, for example, and they use related versions of the same genes to build them. It's intriguing to Lippmann that tomatoes were domesticated, but their cousins, the ground cherries, never were. One possibility for this difference may be that ground cherry DNA doesn't lend itself to easy domestication. Tomatoes, like humans, have two copies of each chromosome, but ground cherries have four. To breed ground cherries for some particular trait, farmers need to find plants that inherited the same mutation on all four copies of one of their genes. It occurred to Lippmann that he could use CRISPR to edit mutations directly into ground cherries instead. Lippmann scooted down an aisle, the leaves brushing against his shoulders. He found a ground cherry bush that he had edited with CRISPR. It had flowered a few days before, and by now the petals had fallen off. The sepals, the leaf-like petals that surround the flower, had expanded to form the papery lanterns inside which the fruit would now develop. On an ordinary ground cherry plant, these lanterns would have five sepals. Lippmann peeled off the sepals on his edited plant, counting them as he went. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Once he had pulled away all the sepals, Lippmann revealed a tiny young ground cherry fruit inside. It had 7 locules now instead of the normal 5. "We could never do this with traditional breeding," Lippmann said. "And we got this," he snapped his fingers, "in one generation. All 4 copies of the gene mutated." Lippmann was soon going to test other edits. He would edit genes that controlled when the fruits fell from the bushes, so that farmers wouldn't have to rummage on the ground for them. He would make a change to get the plants to ripen their fruits in batches rather than a few at a time. He would adjust the plant's response to sunlight so they would start producing fruit early in the growing season. They would grow to a fixed height so that farmers could use machines to gather them. Lippmann planned on starting by editing plants for one trait at a time. If he succeeded, he would then create RNA guides that could alter all the traits at one shot in one plant. When that ground cherry plant reproduced, its offspring could inherit all the genetic machinery required to be a domesticated plant instead of a wild one. "I know this sounds a little ridiculous," Lippmann confessed, "but I think this will be the next berry crop." Having listened to his plan, I didn't think it was ridiculous at all. I thought Lippmann was being too modest. He was trying to replay the agricultural revolution on fast forward. Instead of 1,000 years, he might only need a single growing season. To CRISPR, ground cherries and humans proved pretty much the same. Their DNA was equally easy to cut. Scientists quickly began using CRISPR to edit the genes of human cells, to answer questions about ourselves that once seemed unanswerable. We each carry about 20,000 protein-coding genes, and thousands more genes that encode important RNA molecules. But how many of those do we really need? When mutations shut down some genes, it leads to lethal hereditary diseases. Yet many of us walk about in good health despite inheriting some broken genes. Scientists have long wondered just how many genes in the human genome are absolutely essential to our survival. But they knew it was impossible to actually compile that catalog. CRISPR made it possible. In 2015, 3 separate teams of scientists used CRISPR to shut down all the protein coding genes in human cells, one at a time, to see if the cells could survive without them. They ended up with lists that were pretty much identical. About 2,000 genes, only about 10% of all the protein coding genes in the human genome, proved to be essential. The experiment showed that many genes were expendable because they had backup. If they failed, other genes could take over their jobs. Other scientists began experimenting with CRISPR on human cells with a different goal, to invent new forms of medicine. In December 2013, a team of Dutch researchers demonstrated how CRISPR medicine might work. They took samples of cells from people with cystic fibrosis and raised colonies of them in dishes. The cells all shared the same defective mutation in a gene called CFTR. The scientists fashioned CRISPR molecules that could chop out the mutation, and then they stitched a working version of that DNA in its place. It soon became clear that CRISPR's power was not limited to altering somatic cells. It could change the DNA in germline cells as well. In December 2013, a group of scientists at the Shanghai Institute for Biological Studies in China reported the results of an experiment on mice that suffered from hereditary cataracts. The scientists injected CRISPR molecules into mouse zygotes, and they repaired the mutant gene. The altered mice grew up to be fertile adults, and their descendants gazed through clear eyes. Jennifer Doudna's delight now began getting undercut by worry. CRISPR was turning out to be far more powerful than she had expected. Xingzhu Wang, a geneticist at the Model Animal Research Center at Nanjing University in China, and his colleagues used CRISPR to alter three genes in monkey embryos. They implanted the embryos in a female monkey, and she later gave birth to a pair of healthy twins. If the monkeys had offspring of their own, they'd inherit the CRISPR-altered genes, too. A reporter sent Doudna an advance copy of the monkey paper in January 2014 for her comment. After she read it, she couldn't stop wondering when the first experiments on human embryos would take place. And it was about then when the nightmares started. Sometimes Doudna dreamed she was back in Hawaii, where she had grown up, standing alone on a beach. She saw a low wave in the distance coming toward her, and after a while she realized that it was actually a tsunami. At first she was terrified, but then she found a surfboard and swam straight at the wave. In another recurrent dream, a fellow scientist asked her to meet with someone very powerful. She went into a room. The powerful person turned out to be Hitler. In Doudna's dream, he had the face of a pig. He kept his back turned to Doudna as he jotted down notes. "I want to understand the uses and implications of this amazing technology," the pig-faced Hitler told her. Doudna woke up with her heart pattering. "What," she asked herself, "have we done?" Doudna was hardly the only person getting visits from Hitler. In 2015, a reporter asked the inventor Elon Musk if he was considering getting into the business of reprogramming DNA. Musk is the sort of entrepreneur who blithely sets out to replace the world's fleet of gas-powered cars with electric ones, while simultaneously building the first recyclable rockets. But gene editing gave him pause. "How do you avoid the Hitler problem?" Musk asked in reply to the reporter's question. "I don't know." We must never forget Hitler's genocidal ideology. But we need to remember it for what it was, rather than wrap it around scientific advances that took place 70 years after he died. Hitler wanted Germany's scientists to conquer the future, to build the world's first atomic weapons, to create the first computers. But when it came to biology, he wanted Nazi scientists to revive a mythical past. He had no need for new genes because Aryans already had all the genetic superiority they could hope for. The genetic nostalgia of the Nazis was so powerful that it even extended to other species. Hermann Göring, Hitler's most powerful deputy, became a patron of a project to restore the wild ancestors of cattle. Known as aurochs, these giant animals had become extinct in the Middle Ages. Under Göring's direction, zoologists searched Nazi-held countries for cows that seemed to retain a few vestigial features of aurochs. They bred the cattle, looking among the calves from the ones that appeared to step even further back in time. Göring's goal was to release the restored aurochs in Poland, where they would roam one of the last primeval European forests. He pictured himself as a modern Siegfried from Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung, hunting the same noble beasts as his Aryan ancestors. To clear the path for his romantic vision, Göring emptied the Polish forests of Jews, Polish resistance fighters, and Soviet partisans. The Nazi plans for humanity followed the same lines. The Aryan bloodline needed to be protected, revived, and purified. Systematic murder would protect future generations of Aryans from inferior heredity, and planned pregnancies would concentrate more Aryan blood in future generations, just as breeding would turn cows back into their auric ancestors. The Nazis even forced blonde, blue-eyed people to join an association known as Lebensborn, designed to produce children to restore the Aryan race. After Hitler's defeat, Nazism and other forms of white supremacy did not disappear. As science advanced, latter-day Nazis kept distorting it to feed their genetic nostalgia. They took genetic ancestry tests in the hopes of demonstrating that they were indeed white. Pretty pure damn blood, one member of a computer forum called Stormfront crowed when he got his results. The myth of white purity has endured even after the study of ancient DNA has proven that Europeans have inherited genes from wave after wave of migrants, people with ancestry separated by tens of thousands of years of history, mixing their genes together. A fair number of other Nazis discovered to their horror that they had some Jewish or African ancestry. They coped with the news either by dismissing the results as statistical noise or by arguing that all you need to do to know your past is look in the mirror, a kind of personal bald eagle test. It's also a mistake to use Hitler as a label for all of eugenics. World War II and the horror of the Holocaust brought Hitler's particular version of eugenics to a halt. It also forced conservative forms of eugenics in places like the United States and Great Britain into retreat. But ever since Francis Galton coined the term, eugenics has taken on many different forms, each shaped by the politics and cultures of the people espousing it. And after World War II, a progressive form of eugenics survived. It even rose to prominence. The leading voice for this so-called reform eugenics was a protege of Thomas Hunt Morgan, the American-born biologist Hermann Muller. After Muller learned how to breed Drosophila flies in Morgan's lab at Columbia, he went to the University of Texas, where he used X-rays in the 1920s to create new mutations in the insects. He also came under the FBI's surveillance for advising a left-wing student newspaper that espoused suspicious goals such as Social Security for retired people, equal opportunity for women, and civil rights for African Americans. Muller grew disgusted by the American eugenics movement in the 1920s, its shoddy science, its push to sterilize the weak and ostracize immigrants, and became one of its most outspoken opponents. In 1932, Muller was invited to speak at the Third International Eugenics Congress at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Charles Davenport and the other organizers of the meeting may have assumed he would limit his talk to his work on mutations in flies. To their horror, Muller planned instead to use his speech to burn the American eugenics movement to the ground. Davenport tried to get Muller to cut his talk, originally slated for an hour, down to 15 minutes. Then he demanded it be cut to 10. Muller pushed back, accusing Davenport of trying to stifle dissent, and delivered his full address. On August 23rd, Muller shocked his audience by condemning the idea that poverty and crime in the United States were due to heredity. Only in a society where people's needs were met, where children could grow up in the same environments, could eugenicists ever hope to improve humanity. In a country as rife with inequality as the United States, eugenics could do nothing of the sort. Instead, Muller said, it simply fostered the naive doctrine that the economically dominant classes, races, and individuals are genetically superior. Muller grew so disenchanted with conditions in the United States that he accepted an invitation to do research in Germany. But once he got there, he realized he had made a very bad choice. When Hitler became chancellor, Nazis raided the institution where Muller worked, and he worried that his socialist tendencies and Jewish roots could put his life at risk. Another invitation seemed to offer him a new refuge. Muller left for the Soviet Union, where he was asked to establish a genetics lab in Leningrad. At first, Muller was happy there, working with Soviet students on groundbreaking research. But his timing turned out once again to be disastrous. A plant scientist named Trofim Lysenko rose to prominence by arguing that genetics was a fraud and that heredity was as malleable as clay. Muller took on Lysenko in a public debate, but the audience of 3,000 scientists and farmers shouted him down. When Stalin began arresting and executing scientists, Muller fled the Soviet Union. He went to Spain to serve as a doctor in the Civil War and then traveled to Scotland to teach at the University of Edinburgh. Finally, in 1940, Muller returned to the United States. There, he found stability at last, becoming a professor at Indiana University. His work on mutations had proven to be some of the most important research in modern biology, and in 1946, Muller was awarded the Nobel Prize for his work on mutations. Not long after, he was elected the first president of the newly created American Society of Human Genetics. Now one of the most prominent scientists in the post-war United States, Mueller made the most of his fame by promoting his own vision for social progress. With the fall of Nazi Germany, Mueller believed, the fallacies of its eugenics were exposed. But, he warned his fellow scientists, it is by no means all dead and buried yet, but represents a continuing peril to be vigilantly guarded against by all serious students of human genetics. Mueller urged the fight against American eugenicists, racist propagandists, as Mueller called them, who would try to smuggle their old ideology into post-war genetics. But Mueller also used his newfound megaphone to call for a different kind of eugenics. Eugenics, in the better sense of the term, the social direction of human evolution, is a most profound and important subject, he said. In his research on mutations, Mueller had made an important discovery. From one generation to the next, a species can become burdened with a growing load of mutations. Every new offspring may spontaneously gain new mutations, most of which will be fairly harmless, but added together, they could create diseases and lower fertility. In the wild, natural selection eliminated many of these new mutations. In our own species, Mueller worried that our mutation load would become dangerously large. Thanks to medicine and other advances, natural selection had grown weak in humans, unable to strip out many harmful mutations from the gene pool. It was naive to deny the existence of humanity's mutational load, Mueller argued, but it was even more naive to try to blame it on some despised race or on people with some form of intellectual disability. None of us can cast stones, Mueller said, for we are all fellow mutants together. Still, something had to be done, something beyond making the best of human nature as it is, the while allowing it to slide genetically downhill at an almost imperceptible pace in terms of our mortal timescale, hoping trustfully for some miracle in the future, Mueller said. Mueller had a plan. He called it germinal choice. Traditionally, children could inherit genes only from people who had sex. But in the mid-1900s, sexless reproduction slowly began to emerge. Animal breeders had led the way, perfecting the art of artificial insemination. A prize bull could father countless calves without ever leaving his stanchion. Once breeders figured out how to safely freeze semen, bulls began fathering calves long after their deaths. Doctors quietly started imitating veterinarians, using donated sperm to help couples when the husband was infertile. When the practice came to light, it was roundly condemned. The Pope declared donor insemination adultery. In a 1954 divorce case, an Illinois judge ruled that a child produced by donated sperm was born out of wedlock. But the practice grew more common and less controversial. By 1960, about 50,000 children in the United States had been conceived with donated sperm. Mueller's germinal choice plan would turn artificial insemination into a national, perhaps even global, campaign against the mutation load. The sperm from the finest specimens of manhood would be collected and stored away in subterranean freezers to protect their DNA from radiation and cosmic rays. The sperm from a single man could theoretically produce hundreds, perhaps thousands, of children. In the 1950s, eggs were proving harder for scientists to handle than sperm, but Mueller was optimistic that, at some point, the underground germ cell bunkers could store samples from superior women as well. The public would then be educated about the coming mutational catastrophe and be invited to use the superior eggs and sperm to build their own families. Forward-minded couples would appreciate the scale of the threat and be the first to step forward. To avoid any awkward encounters with the biological parents, Mueller would offer gametes only from people who had been dead for 20 years. The volunteers would have to be ready to withstand the ignorant mockery of others, but as they raised their obviously glorious children, with the innate quality of such men as Lenin, Newton, Beethoven, and Marx, Mueller promised, other parents would follow in their path. They will form a growing vanguard that will increasingly feel more than repaid by the day-to-day manifestations of their solid achievements, as well as by the profound realization of the value of the service they are rendering, Mueller predicted. Mueller's germinal choice plan was met with nods and curiosity. Leading scientific journals asked him to write about it. Conferences invited him to speak. Newspapers and magazines ran interviews with him. Mueller's fellow Nobelists considered germinal choice a step in the right direction. For all its science fiction luster, however, Mueller's germinal choice was still a fairly traditional form of eugenics. It was what Francis Galton had called for in the 19th century, an imitation of what animal and plant breeders had been doing for centuries, combining existing genetic variations into better arrangements that could be inherited by descendants. Germinal choice didn't require rewriting genes. Apparently, that was too much even for Hermann Muller to imagine. While Muller's vision of a public germinal choice program never came to pass, a private version did. Sperm banks emerged from the shadows, taking on not just married heterosexual couples, but single women and lesbian couples as well. By the early 2000s, over 1 million children had been born with donated sperm in the United States alone. While sperm banks tended to keep their donors anonymous, they allowed customers to pick men based on certain traits. Traits, it must be said, that probably don't get transmitted in the chemistry packed inside a sperm cell. The Fairfax Cryobank, located in Virginia, lets customers search by a donor's astrological sign, favorite subject in school, arts, history, languages, mathematics, natural science, religion, favorite pet, bird, cat, dog, fish, reptile, small animal, personal goals, community service, fame, financial security, further education, God, religion, and hobbies, musical, team sports, individual sports, culinary, craftsman. Looking at that list, I picture parents putting their child in a wood shop and waiting for freshly carved coffee tables to pile up. In order to become a sperm donor, men have to get through a screening for sexually transmitted diseases, as required by the FDA. But there aren't any regulations about checking DNA, and so genetic screening varies from clinic to clinic. Many of them look at a prospective donor's family history for signs of a hereditary disease. Many also carry out a few genetic tests to see if donors are carriers of diseases such as cystic fibrosis. Sometimes a dangerous variant can slip through the screening. In 2009, for example, a Minnesota cardiologist discovered that a young patient with a hereditary heart condition had been the result of sperm donation. He tracked down the donor and discovered that he carried a dangerous variant. Out of 22 children he fathered with donated sperm, 9 inherited his faulty gene. One of them died of a heart attack at age 2. The falling price of DNA sequencing may be able to eliminate most of these disasters. Rather than look for a handful of common disease variants, it is now possible to scan every protein-coding gene in a potential sperm donor. Men with a dominant disease-causing mutation could be barred altogether from donating sperm. To avoid recessive diseases, doctors could sort through sperm and eggs to make sure they couldn't combine 2 dangerous mutations. Muller was right to expect eggs to be harder to use for germinal choice. In the 1930s, scientists were able to fertilize rabbit eggs in a dish with rabbit sperm and coax the embryos to start dividing. But it wasn't until the 1960s, however, that 2 scientists, a University of Cambridge physiologist named Robert Edwards and a gynecologist named Patrick Steptoe, figured out how to get viable eggs from women. Their next challenge was to find a chemical cocktail, the magic fluid, as Edwards called it, that could keep the eggs alive in a dish long enough to be fertilized. In 1970, Edwards and Steptoe announced that they had succeeded at last. After they fertilized human eggs, they managed to keep them alive for 2 days, during which they divided into as many as 16 cells. Edwards spoke about this milestone at a meeting in Washington, D.C. in 1971. One of his fellow panelists was a professor of religion named Paul Ramsey. After Edwards finished speaking, Ramsey declared the procedure an abomination that must be banned. He believed it would bring the world closer to the introduction of unlimited genetic changes into human germinal material. Heredity, in other words, was a sanctuary that humans dare not enter. Edwards and Steptoe weren't scared away by Ramsey's warnings. Instead, they invited couples having trouble getting pregnant to come to them for help. In 1978, they had their first success, a healthy girl named Louise Joy Brown. Louise's birth led people to see in vitro fertilization not as the first step to human genetic engineering, but as a treatment for infertility. In the 1980s, in vitro fertilization clinics opened up across the world, capitalizing on the pent-up demand of struggling couples. The procedure remained hit or miss, though, with many embryos failing to implant. To improve their odds, fertility doctors would produce batches of embryos and then pick out the healthiest among them. In time, it became possible to inspect an embryo's DNA, too. Scientists would analyze a single cell removed from an embryo in its first few days of life and analyze its genes. If a cell is removed at that stage, the remaining ones can still proliferate into a healthy fetus. Fertility doctors could use this method to reduce the odds that parents would pass down a genetic disorder to their children. In one early experiment, a team of British doctors treated women who carried disease-causing mutations on one of their X chromosomes. The women themselves were healthy thanks to their second X chromosome, which lacked the mutation, but any sons they might have would run a 50% chance of developing